Good evening. Thanks for coming. Welcome to Ed Holohan Live, The View From Here. My name is Margot Hipwell, and I'm going to be your host for this evening. Ed and I have been doing our respective things at WDRT since the early days, so we thought it a perfect fit that we do this show together. As you know, tonight's performance is a benefit for your community radio station. We will be passing the hat halfway through the program, so please give generously. If you had any idea what we're paying Ed for tonight, you would give and give again. Since this is Ed's show, you know that he would want a great musical opener. Classical, of course. So we went out and got Stephanie Pedretti. Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie. A little bit about the man of the hour. Ed Holohan began writing and reading The View from Here 13 years ago. He has been talking to us every Friday morning since November of 2010. That's a lot of Fridays. 660 essays later, we thought it would be a good idea to hear him in person. He'll be reading from some of your favorites. He'll digress, of course. His middle name is Digression. He'd welcome questions, too, if you have any. But take it easy on him. He embarrasses easily. So let's get to it. Ladies and gentlemen, Ed Holohan, live.
You're so sweet. Thank you. This is a tad overwhelming. Thank you. I'm going to start with an essay called The Crossing. It was one of the first that I did. It's a fond look back at the days when the magnificent ocean liners crossed the Atlantic. They began their voyage to Europe from the west side of Manhattan. I happen to be lucky enough to have grown up there. When I was a boy in New York, under the benign tutelage of my brother, we studied the scheduled sailings of the great ocean liners of the day. These were the final years of the transatlantic crossings, the real deal. America to Europe in a week on ships of such size and dignity as to leave you breathless. Understand, we never sailed on one. They were far beyond our means. We just went to see them off. In those days, the west side of Manhattan was ribbed with giant piers stretching out into the Hudson River. It was a time when nations would show their pride by the ships they put out to sea. There were many players, but the game was dominated by Britain, France, Italy, and the United States. I'll give you a few names, but only if you promise to do yourself a favor and Google one or two of them. Find pictures of them and know that they were real. There were the queens, of course. That would be Elizabeth and Mary. The France, the Da Vinci and the Michelangelo from Italy, and the SS United States, which in our creativity we painted black and white. How can I describe them? How can I possibly do them justice? These were cities afloat. Every detail, every nuance, every refinement was taken into account. Their hundreds of brass rails were polished, the glass sparkled, their enormous hulls were always freshly painted. I don't know how you do that when you're at sea for a week. How do you? I don't know. The anchor chains, and I'm serious, with links the size of your truck. That's a serious chain. And they were scrubbed of barnacles. The fortunate passengers knew that they were sailing aboard the perfect expression of engineering and design. So why did we go to the docks if we weren't sailing? We went to be a part of something that was so far beyond our everyday fare that it bordered on the fairy tale. We took the subway to Times Square, and we walked the rest of the way to the river. We paid 50 cents to the Seaman's Fund. This is the old days when 50 cents would get you something. And we walked up that gangplank and into splendor. 50 cents got you aboard and free to wander. 50 cents let you pass through the myriad bon voyage parties in full swing on the several decks of each of these giant ships. 50 cents let you mingle with the swells in their tennis whites, sipping cocktails. 50 cents let you get the feeling of why exactly people fight to get rich. Excuse me. We had about an hour to pretend at being Gatsby. And then a whistle blew, and the announcement was made by meticulously dressed porters that it was time to go ashore, please. down the enormous gangplank, 20 feet wide, and onto the pier, there to await the single most thrilling moment of the entire morning, the blast of a ship's horn, as she tells the world to stand back and wish us well. Huh, there's nothing like it. It hits you in the chest first. It's like great fireworks, you know, percussive. It hits you in the chest. It makes you take a step back. Then you move to cover your ears, but the sound is overwhelming. Then the captain gives her two more blasts. By now your pulse is racing and you want to laugh or cry or shout. Let's cry or shout, not crowd or shy. Then cry. I didn't know I spoke German. That was really... Wow. Laugh or cry or shout, anything but take the subway back home. So picture yourself looking straight up at the bow, 80 feet, that's eight stories, 80 feet above your head. Now picture 1,000 feet of steel stretching away horizontally behind it, 1,000 feet. Now imagine that this huge thing moves, hardly a ripple at first. It takes 5 minutes just to clear the pier, 5 minutes to move 1,500 feet. Imagine that. In those days, tugboats took the liners away from their berths, and every tug was named Moran. Of course, this is New York, Moran. Each one was named for a daughter of the clan. There was the Katie Moran and the Moira Moran and the Molly Moran. My brother and I were at the docks on a day when the France was sailing. Now, the France was the largest of them all at 1,200 feet, easily the finest ship afloat. The currents were strong that day on the Hudson River. They were really strong, and the normal contingent of four tugboats couldn't handle the ship. The France started to go down the Hudson sideways. This is 1,200 feet, headed for the Verrazano Bridge, sideways. It was impressive. You have never seen so many boats appear so quickly from so many docks along that river. In a New York minute, there were 12 tugs alongside the France, desperately trying to get her pointed down the channel the right way. There was Bridget and Mary and Una and Caitlin Moran. They were all pushing against her port side with everything. That's right, Caitlin. There was a Caitlin Moran. Huge rooster tails at their sterns. Well, you already know the outcome. The Morans never fail. Ever. The France was turned around 90 degrees in less than a mile, and I bet that her passengers never knew anything was wrong. Well, that was back in the 60s, but more like an eon ago. The regular Atlantic crossing is a thing of the past, but those giant queens of the sea will always live in the still clear memories of the lucky souls who saw them go and waved them on their way. This is an appendage. I don't know why it's there, but it's there. Thank you. My brother was a strange and wonderful bird. I mean, he was different, really different. He was 2 years older than I. We both obviously went to high school in New York. He took his subway to Brooklyn. I took my subway to the other side of Queens. It was a 45-minute commute to high school. We were as well educated on the subway as we were at high school. It's a great way to learn about life. Anyway, my Joe, that was my brother, was a huge fan of classical music. He taught me everything I know about music, seriously. He was a better than average amateur violinist, and he was a brilliant, I'm going to use the word, accordionist. Yeah, I only wish he were around now, you know, here in Wisconsin. This guy would be a superstar. He was an unbelievable player. He'd do all the standards, you know, waltzes, polkas, da-da-da. But his forte, his specialty, was concertos for accordion and orchestra. Yes, Virginia, there are concertos written for accordion. He would go into Manhattan, go to Skirmerhorn's, which was a bookstore at that time, and buy The Score, come home all excited, reading it on the subway, and he'd play these crazy things. Anyway, he had a favorite composer. It was Herr Beethoven himself. And he was such a fan of that giant of music that every 15th of December, he would ask my mother to bake a dozen cupcakes. And yeah, you're getting ahead of me. The next morning on the 16th of December, which as Mike Nordskog will tell you is Beethoven's birthday, it happens to be Mike's birthday too, my brother would take that 45-minute commute to Brooklyn with his impossibly heavy book bag in one hand and a paper sack with a dozen cupcakes in the other hand. This is the morning commute in New York. He's being squashed. Why did he do that? So that at lunchtime he could sit with 11 of his buddies and wish Beethoven a happy birthday. True story. Maybe the only true story tonight, but that's a true story. That was my brother. What does it say here? Oh, yeah. I couldn't remember why I was walking over to a chair. Yes. Now I do. Because it's much more comfortable than being over there. Over the years, I've written episodes from an entirely made-up history of Viroqua. The history I reported was told to me by one John Johnson. He was also entirely made up. I'm going to read two of those stories. But before I begin, I need to tell you that these tales and all the John Johnson stories I think I'm supposed to breathe here. Okay, rewind. I need to tell you that these tales and all the John Johnson stories originally appeared in the Kickapoo Free Press. It just so happens that the publisher, editor, city desk, sales department, and delivery truck driver of that august and sorely missed publication was Anne O'Connor. She's here tonight, and she deserves your applause. Thank you, Anne, and thank you again. Okay, this is one of my favorite pieces of true history. Just so happens as this was KJ's favorite story, too. I don't know if she's here tonight, but she was a big fan of John Johnson. This story was told to me in 2010. It was one of the first bits of history that I learned about our town. It has since been made clear to me that the facts were stretched a bit in the telling. John Johnson, who claimed to be 87 or 94 or 109, depending on the day, was the man who told me the story. It goes like this. In that particular year, it began to snow in October, around Columbus Day. Remember when there used to be a Columbus Day? That was funny. Columbus Day. And snowed continuously for 4 months. Yep, every day for 4 months. I remember because Valentine's Day was the first day without snow all winter long. It was so deep by New Year's Day that we were walking around town at the second story level. True story. Folks learned to keep their bedroom curtains drawn that winter. Oh, it began innocently enough, like some natural disasters do, kind of sneaky-like, and then before you know it, you're watching the barn blow away. How did that happen? Early October had been quite lovely, as I recall. The hunter's moon nights and Indian summer days were gorgeous. And then, as I say, it began to snow on the 12th. Folks remarked that it was kind of early for snow, but heck, every year is different, right? On the second day, folks smiled and they shook their heads, but it was still just a dusting. By the end of the first week of light snow, the fields and sidewalks were pretty well covered. Then commenced a couple of weeks of heavy snow, the stuff that sticks and piles up and stops traffic. By the time Thanksgiving rolled around, we were housebound a month before Christmas, and there was no doubt that we'd have a white one. So there we were, still early in the season, and the snow is starting to mount up so that we have to dig out our front doors every morning. In town it was rough, but out on the farms, oh, let me tell you, it was murder. In those days, you didn't just call the plow guy. You dug yourself out, or you didn't get dug out. There were plenty of folks that year who were between their last turnip and a hard place. By December, we were putting everything on runners, you know, like on sleds. Baby buggies had runners, shopping baskets had runners, wagons and carts had runners, even boats had runners. You never saw anything like it. My personal favorite was Carl Olofsson, who was the mail carrier in those days. That young fellow could do anything on skis that other folks could do on foot, uphill, downhill, traverse, cross step, it didn't matter. Carl could do it. He pulled his mail pouch on a sled behind him, and not a single Christmas letter was late. He took it as a personal challenge that every holiday card and package would get to where it was going, dry and in time for the big day. Now, another thing, necessity being the mother of invention, another thing folks learned to do was to cook with snow. One way to get rid of all that white stuff was to melt it, so why not melt it on the stove or in the oven? I remember dear old Elsa Gruden wrote a cookbook about cooking with snow. Being Norwegian, that's what she called it, cooking with snow. She did the basics like boiled eggs and snow cones, but she broke new culinary ground with breaded snow fritters. They were good. And snow almondine. The book is out of print now. I sure would like to find a copy of Cooking with Snow. By the middle of January, the snow was so deep that folks had ceased raking their roofs and had commenced digging tunnels. First, they dug a tunnel from one house to a neighbor's house, and then they dug down the length of a block, and by the end of the month, there were tunnels running clear across town. From the courthouse to the normal school, there were tunnels. I walked home from school through tunnels with a kerosene lamp, holding my little sister's hand. We got lost once for 2 days. Until Bert Midham's Labrador Retriever Percy found us and brought us home. Children were tougher then. People had moved their bird feeders out of their yards and up to their roof weeks ago. In fact, anything that used to be on the ground was moved up. Mailboxes, milk cans, porch furniture, all of it found a new perch in high up places. I remember our welcome mat was just outside my bedroom window. And more than one neighbor used that same window as our new front door. I was annoyed. It got really gloomy on the first floor of the house, as what used to be a bright parlor was now more of a icy blue cave. Ooh, yeah, you got it. Ooh. The kitchen with those big south-facing windows felt more like an aquarium now. You almost expected a giant face to appear on the other side, staring in at you. Take my word for it, friend. Daylight filtered through 20 feet of snow can give a guy the creeps. So whenever I hear folks, don't drop your book, whenever I hear folks complain about the weather, I tell them, you ain't seen nothing. Now, the winter of 1932, that was a winter. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I got 660 of them. Yeah, this was too much fun. The always amusing Marjorie Taylor Greene was a featured speaker at the wonderfully underattended Trump indictment protest in Manhattan. You remember that one? There was like 20 people going, "Yeah, you're still the president." While in New York, she opined that a lot of great men in history have also been arrested, just like her best friend Donald Trump. She named Nelson Mandela and Jesus Christ as two examples to make her point. Donald Trump, Nelson, it's ridiculous. Donald Trump, Nelson Mandela, and Jesus Christ. Oh, Marjorie. Okay, let's stick with Jesus for a minute. It's been standard practice for a long time that evangelical Christians ask the question, what would Jesus do, when faced with morally and ethically challenging situations? And it's an effective technique. It gets right to the point. What would your guiding light do if he were in your shoes? Since Marjorie thinks that Donald Trump and Jesus Christ inhabit the same rarefied air, let's look at some events from the life of Jesus Christ and ask ourselves, what would Donald do? The first question in issue, of course, is Mary Magdalene. A woman with a less than chaste history whose story might present a problem for Jesus' mission on earth. So here's the problem. How should Jesus handle a sex star? Let's flip Marjorie's imaginary cellmates and have Jesus ask, what would Donald do? Would he, A, send Peter to pay Mary a few hundred drachma to shut her up and to go away? B, pay Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John a bag of gold each to keep the Magdalene story out of their gospels and the tabloids? C, deny that he ever met Mary and make it clear that she's not his type anyway. Thank you. Well, they all sound like Donald. That's answer D. And if you answered D, all of the above, you got it right. Let's try another one. I do love life stories. You're in the temple, and the favor seekers, the money lenders, and the golf cheats are all around you, looking to make a deal. Ask yourself, what would Donald do? A, hold up a borrowed copy of the Torah for a photo op. Of course, it's upside down, but, you know, whatever. Redecorate the temple, turning it into a casino. Tip over the table trading non-fungible tokens because they're not selling Donald's non-fungible tokens. Deliver a sermon stating that money is the root of all evil. If you answer D, that money is the root of all evil, we're not talking about the same Donald. So the answer is not D. Okay, it's time for the Sermon on the Mount. What would Donald say? Blessed are the winners because the meek are losers. Blessed are they that didn't get invited to John McCain's funeral, because mourning is for losers. Whosoever looketh on a woman with lust is just like me, because winners grab women whenever and wherever we feel like grabbing them. That's what Donald would say. Donald ended the sermon with his standard closer, "Be ye perfect, even as I am perfect, and send me a few bucks." When the scribes asked the Donald what to do about paying taxes, the Donald said, "Render unto Donald the things that are Donald's, and render unto Donald the things that are not Donald's. Hell, just render unto Donald. I'll keep selling me just as long as you suckers keep buying me." When the Donald came upon a leper, he proclaimed, "Ew! A leper!" When the Donald came upon a blind man, he picked his pocket. When the Donald came upon a child with palsy, well, he mocked her muscle spasms, and he got a big laugh with that one. When the Donald came upon Lazarus, he said, "Boy, I'm glad I'm not you." When his disciples, Marjorie and Stephen and Rudy and Sidney, met him on the road to Mar-a-Lago after his sentencing, he said unto them, "Oh, ye of little faith, don't you know that I was never convicted? Fake news. But take heart, just continue to kiss my ass, and you will join me forever on that golden escalator." The more I think about it, the more I realize that Marjorie, the always amusing Marjorie, is right when she references Jesus. Now, I don't know what Ms. Green's favorite verses are, but I like this passage from Scripture in particular. And Jesus said, "Whoever causes one of these who believeth in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a millstone hung around his neck and he be drowned." I wonder if Jesus was thinking of Donald in particular. Does anybody know? Do we still make millstones? Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you ever so much. Ah, yes. Our fan. I'm getting out of the way. This is I had the most wonderful experience a few weeks ago. I attended the Rainbow Bridge ceremony at Pleasant Ridge Waldorf School. I am still in its spell. "Make new friends, but keep the old. One is silver and the other is gold." That's a simple song and a true song. A song that is best sung in rounds, best sung with improvised harmonies. A song that is best sung by everyone, together. That's how the ceremony ended, with that song, the ceremony that opened the academic year at Pleasant Ridge Waldorf School. The center point, the main focus of that ceremony, is the welcoming, the initiation of the brand new first graders. Tiny people. It's a shock every year. I mean, you know, they're like this big. You're big. Tiny, tiny people. A mixture of awestruck and aw-shucks, they are introduced one by one to the assembled families and friends. Their buddies, the eighth graders, take them across the Rainbow Bridge, which is a short span that begins their long journey through formal education. The way a child negotiates that bridge is a signal, isn't it? A hint as to how that child will go at their education, how that child will go at life. Excuse me. Most of the brand new first graders are a little cautious. The bridge crossing is not strenuous. They've all done something like it at home or on the playground 1,000 times. But they have never done it in front of hundreds of people, most of those people strangers. You'll notice, if you're looking for such things, that a few of them are very cautious, stepping carefully, crossing slowly. They look down. They're making sure. I suspect that they will come to conversation and reading and learning with that same care, attention to detail. Maybe even patience, but careful to be sure. Then came a little boy who took the three steps up in two steps. He bounced briskly across the bridge. He gave us all a wave and a smile, and he hopped down the other side, no steps, to join his classmates. I think this little guy, I think he will converse easily. I think he will have many friends. I think he will learn what he wants to learn. I think he will be a star in the world, or maybe get into a lot of trouble. Probably both. Mary and I began reading to children at the school library 8 years ago. For reading! The children were first graders when we met each other. They were the tiny people. Those people are the eighth graders now, the big kids. The difference in physical stature between the eighth and the first graders is astounding. They will be year-long buddies, the eighth and the first graders, mentors and newbies, experience holding hands with wonder. Now, I didn't notice until the end of the festivities that every first grader was wearing a ribbon around their neck, and at the end of that ribbon, there hung a tiny brass bell. As their brand new teacher led them out of the assembly, they shook their tiny bells, and the bells twinkled like stars, a joyous sound, music at its most basic, I think. I happened to be standing near the door as the children exited the room. And here again, their personalities were fully on display, couched in innocence, of course. Some were vigorous bell ringers. Some were deliberate. One or two forgot to ring, and one seemed perfectly happy just to be wearing a bell. I like that kid. Now, I like to interact with children. I can't help it. I like to gesture when I catch their eye. An excited wave, a big thumbs up, or a very low high five go a long way to telling a child that you really are glad they're on the planet. Some beam a big smile back at me and some giggle, but they all respond. The words will come as they mature, but for now, their faces say it all. Now, I grew up in an educational system that was academically superior, really great curriculum, really great teachers. The collected knowledge of the world was at my fingertips. I was lucky. I was an avid reader, a student of letters and history. My teachers opened those doors to me. Now, my father, he took care of my hands, teaching me to build and to draw. We made stuff together. But no one taught me about my heart. No one encouraged expression. No one said that I should be confident in myself. I had to do all that work on my own. So I'm standing at that school and I'm thinking about these new first graders, children who will have it all, heart and head and hands every day for the next 8 years. Lucky them, and lucky us to help them along the way. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. And I love you right back. I love you right back. Well, let's see now. I seem to have the pages. I grew up Catholic, so by the time I was 14, I had gone to confession 8 jillion times, at least. Which was a lot, because I quit going to confession when I was 15. As it so happens, I returned to the practice of confession 55 years later, by writing this essay, True Confessions, coming up. It's okay, I'm not embarrassed much anymore. It's called When the Cat's Away. That's my darling daughter, who know some of these stories. Thank you, dear. I love it. I love it when you get the giggles. That's my darling Gay, who gets the giggles too. That's my darling Mike, who gets the giggles too. Mary has been away on a mission of mercy for the past few weeks, far away at the other end of the country. So like any red-blooded man in the 21st century, I saw my big chance to cut loose a bit. Yep. You know, to do all the things that one doesn't do when one's partner is in the house. I'm sure we all have a list. You don't have to tell me now, but I'm sure we do. Guilty little pleasures that beckon when the usual restraints are off. I'm only human, after all. Only human. On the very day that Mary left, I made myself a mound of glorious, glutinous pasta. Gluten, gluten, I love you. Beautifully stuffed tortellini, cheesy goodness in a semolina pillow, just to say semolina. Then I headed again for lunch the next day. Now, I couldn't possibly have tortellini three meals in a row, so for supper on the second night, I made a divine clam sauce and served it over linguine. Gluten-full linguine. The perfect pasta. I think it's the best of all the long noodles. It's not too fat, it's not too skinny. It's just white enough to hold the sauce. Now, indulging in food that I don't eat when Mary is here is one thing. I knew I was going to fall hard in that department, and Mary did too. In fact, when she arrived at her destination and phoned to check in, the first thing she asked me was, so, what's for pasta tonight? Yeah, we both knew I was going to succumb to gluten. But it was my bedroom behavior that stunned me. What, ha? I resisted for 3 days, but by bedtime of the fourth night, I couldn't stand it any longer. But before I tell you what happened, let me remind you that I am the most faithful of partners. 44 years of monogamous bliss, 44 years of one and only one true love. I don't say this to forgive myself for what I did, but rather as a context for your judgment of me later. I'm as faithful as they come. And then it happened. Brace yourselves. I slept diagonally. Diagonally across our bed. I swam in the delicious open space of our king-size mattress. I tried it on my back. I tried it on both sides. I tried it curled up and all stretched out, flapping like I was making a snow angel on the bed. I diagonaled with the lights on. Yep. I diagonaled in the pitch dark. And then I opened the shutters and I diagonaled. And then I did it all again, only this time with my feet pointing northwest, which lasted a delicious 10 minutes. Then I switched and pointed my feet to the southeast. You see, the possibilities are really endless. You ought to try it. So many variations on my newfound boudoir boogie. I had fallen hard, and I was drunk with excitement. Until I tried to go to sleep. I didn't even get close to nodding off. As exhausted as I was from my wild experimentations, I just couldn't get comfortable enough to doze. So I rolled myself back onto my half of the bed, the half that I sleep on every night when Mary and I share that bed, and I was asleep in a minute. That's my usual pattern, snoring contentedly into the night. So much for my madcap fling, though, my flirtation with desire. Honestly, I haven't tried it since. Haven't even thought about it. Aside from bedroom adventures and glutinous gluttony, I have pursued other racy pastimes this week, things that I usually forbid myself. It's funny what a fellow lets out of the bag when he's left alone. In no particular order, here they are. I painted the front door red. I painted the garage door white. I dug a new bed to hold the perennials over the winter. I pruned and I staked out the tomatoes. I chopped the goldenrod. I mowed the violets. I tasted the plums and washed the car. Okay, I made that last one up. I suppose I knew that there would be a price to pay for all my hectic hedonism while Mary was gone, and there was. I happened to be writing this piece from my recliner in the big sunroom at Shady Rest Home, over there by the fairgrounds, you know. Yep, I exhausted myself. I'm lucky to be lucid, a classic case of overdoing it. I'm on a steady diet of electrolytes and Bonanza reruns these days. Some of you have been there, I see. Yes. It's a great place. I'm not knocking it. They say it might take a while for me to recover. I'm one of the most acute cases they've ever seen. A clear case of nihil feline rodentitis. Yes, nihil feline rodentitis. That's what it says on the chart at the foot of my bed, really. I asked the night nurse, give it to me straight, will ya? What the hell do those words mean? She looked me right in the eye and said, when the cat's away, the mouse will play. Then she clicked off Bonanza, gave me my bedtime Ensure, and said, rest up, old timer. Your wife will be back next week. Margo Hipwell, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, I have one more for you. It might be my favorite. Nah, they're all my babies. It's about being a grandpa and a fool and the luckiest man alive. It's called The Unicorn. I was scrolling through some old pictures the other day, one of those lazy walks down memory lane, when I came across an image of a very young Ella Houston Moore, who is our granddaughter. She's almost 22 now and is making a name for herself at Berkeley. But in the picture before me, she's 4 years old and she is tiny. She has her arms around a unicorn. Yep, a unicorn. The photo was taken in 2005 at a county fair in the state of Florida. That particular day in Florida is on a very short list of the very best days of my life. The county fair was like so many others, except that it was February and the temperature was 78 degrees. There was cotton candy and hot dogs and animal judging and giant watermelons and a tilt-a-whirl. It was at the beginning of the opening afternoon and the place had not yet gotten busy. I love times like this in a venue that will soon be teeming with humanity, but for now is still rubbing the sleep from its eyes. It's a unique atmosphere. It's like batting practice before a big league ball game. So with Ella in her stroller, We possess the proud confidence that grandparents have as we strode into the Kearney Games corridor, just itching for action. Our very first stop, not a dime spent yet, was the three balls in a bucket booth. You know that one. Now, this is a classic game. Even if you know how to finesse it, the odds of getting three balls in succession into that bucket are very slim. It's a house game. They all are. That's the point. So, of course, I went for the top row of buckets, the most difficult by far, in order to win one of those top row prizes. As soon as we got to the booth, Ella spied a giant, twice her size, a pink and purple stuffed animal, a unicorn. It was stupendous. It was everything a four-year-old had ever imagined in her tiny life. It had blue, sparkly eyes. It had a silver horn. It was, in short, the greatest single thing she had ever seen. Grampy, could you win that? My motivation was pure. Now, I've promised some stupid things in my life, usually out of love, and always from an unreasonable confidence in my own abilities. I looked at that beautiful little girl in her stroller and proudly spoke our favorite phrase of affirmation. "You betcha," I said. "You betcha." She was beaming. Yep. So I put my dollar down and I arranged the three softballs on the counter in front of me. Then I rearranged them, you know, getting comfortable. Now, I was unconscious at this point. I was in the zone, as any great athlete will tell you. I picked them up, I felt them, I weighed them mentally, asked each ball in what order they wanted to go. We were one, the softballs and I. We were in the bucket even before we began to play. You see, when you play at this level, you never say, "If I make the bucket," you say, "When I make the bucket." Now, I knew I wanted to hit the back wall of the bucket first, not the bottom. The buckets are shallow. If the ball contacts the bottom first, it will bounce right back out. I've seen it 1,000 times. So the first ball goes in. Oh, no worries, smooth as silk. The second ball barely cleared the front edge of the bucket, clattered around in there, and it almost came back out. There's one more ball to go, and I can see that the bucket is basically full. There are only two balls in there, but the bucket is almost full. You see, that's another trick of this game. The last ball will require 10% technique and 90% luck to stay in that bucket that has no room for it. But now is not the time to think. Now is the time to just be the ball. Just be the ball in the bucket. Win the unicorn. Tosses up, it rattles, it settles, it's in! We have won the game. The fabulously pink and purple gigantic unicorn with a silver horn is Ella's. She is the happiest girl on the planet, and her grampy is elevated to Olympian status. I am Olympus. We took delivery of that unicorn and piled it carefully on top of Ella in her stroller. She disappeared, hugging it in a state that can only be described as rapture. The clearly shaken Kearney man looked at me and said, Hey, this is going to be one of those days. My first player, he cleans me out. Do me a favor, will you, buddy? Tell everyone where you won that prize. I need a chance to get even today. So I turned to the stroller and I said, "We can do that, can't we, Ella?" And from somewhere beneath her glorious unicorn, Ella's tiny voice called out, "You betcha, Grampy." Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Hey, baby. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you all for coming out tonight.
Yes, thank you so much. Charlie, where are you, Charlie?
We hope you had as much fun out there as we had over here.
Charlie Noah. Thank you, and thank you, and thank you. Say goodnight, Margo.
Goodnight, Margo.